Hello, this is Chuck from Above the Basement, Boston Music and Conversation. Classical music is pretty much the only music in the world that still sounds beautiful when the musicians are tuning up. That was Megumi Lewis, Omar Chengui, Caitlin Lynch, J. Cosmos Lee, and Jason Fisher, several of the criers from the Boston-based chamber orchestra, A Far Cry. We invited these fine musicians to City Winery Boston for another live concert cast. Founded in 2007, A Far Cry has been nominated for 3 Grammys. Playing music from various time periods, they incorporate both new and time-tested works with the goal, and I quote, to wrestle the music they love back from the cultural baggage it's accumulated. Throughout the episode, you will hear movements of Dvorak's Terzetto, played by J. Cosmos Lee, Omar Chengui, and Jason Fisher. Caitlin Lynch then joins Jason and Jay for a conversation with Ronnie and I, and answers a few questions from the audience. The final piece they played for us will be published separately as part of our in-concert series. Check the show notes for that link. It sounds absolutely beautiful. So here is our conversation with A Far Cry, recorded in front of a live audience at City Winery Boston in Boston, Massachusetts.
It's really my pleasure to introduce the 3 criers that will start the evening. We're going to have Mr. J. Cosmos Lee, Mr. Omar Gway, and Mr. Jason Fisher. They are going to do a Dvorak piece called Terzetto.
Pretty good. He practiced that for a while.
And Terzetto, for anyone in the audience that is not Italian, means a small string trio. Apparently, Dvorak is a piece that you play when your cellist is sick or has died or has gone on vacation. Okay, so you have 2 violins and you have a viola. And what I learned about Dvorak is that in the late 1800s, he wrote this piece over 3 days. Do you know that, Chuck?
I learned
3 days. But anyway, without further ado, Jay, Omar, and Jason, come on up.
Thank you.
Omar, Gui, Jay, Cosmos Lee, Jason Fisher. Let's give another round of applause. It's fantastic.
So thank you all for being here. I love doing this part. I have a first very civilian type question for you. I'm always afraid I'm going to be the schmuck who claps at the wrong time during these things.
I almost did.
It must happen all the time, right? And you, do you put money on who's going to clap at the wrong time when you guys play?
No, but I should, though.
You should?
Yeah.
I'm terrified. I'm like, no one else is clapping. Okay, I don't
know. No, you know, it's actually coming back into style.
To clap between?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm part of, aside from a Far Cry, all of us do other ensembles. And one of the orchestras I play for, they just sent out a mass mail saying, like, when do you clap? And now they're talking about, it's like a whole blog on why you should clap whenever you feel like it.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, but it would also raise a lot of eyebrows with, you know, the general concert goer. But I mean, all I think they're trying to do it like really clandestinely.
The uppity concert goers who will go and see you guys.
Yeah,
not these people.
These
aren't uppities.
I think it's actually really unfortunate because a lot of times you hear people say that they're scared to go to classical music concerts because they don't want to mess up by clapping at the wrong time.
Yeah,
and it's such a shame. I feel like that's. It's a travesty. I love hearing people clap in the wrong spot because that means they liked it.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, clap.
That's what you want.
You know what's great is when...
Or like a woo.
Yeah,
no, you want to hear
absolutely.
That too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. So now from now on, you should all be clapping all the time.
Well, I think when the MBTA goes through...
Yes.
That is special.
That's when you stomp your feet. That's
yeah.
When you do that. But I get the second question too. You had a very special month. Going down to the Grammys for your three Grammy nominations.
Two. Was our third nomination.
Let me clarify.
Clarify this.
Whoa.
Dreams and Prayers, right here, 2014.
Yes.
It's out in the lobby. First Grammy nomination.
Oh, okay. So that was an earlier Grammy nomination.
No, this is a math lesson. Okay. That's one. And then the second two were just recently this month. A Far Cry, Visions and Variations. That was for the second two Grammys. One for chamber, one for classical music.
So who was the loser who won?
They weren't even there.
That old group, the Kronos Quartet.
Kronos, never heard of them.
And we weren't allowed to be mad at them because they were busy working on their Music with Refugees project.
So oh.
We couldn't be upset.
The whole refugee thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess we'll let them off the hook there. But congratulations. I want to know about... that whole experience of going down there, being a nominee, what it's like to be huge stars like you guys. Tell me about that.
It's a spectacle.
It
the
is
Grammys.
A spectacle, yeah.
It's actually, you know, really disorganized, if I'm going to be honest.
It is really disorganized.
We didn't really know where to go.
Although when we went in 2014, we actually got there early. We were all so gung-ho about, like, we have to get there on time.
Yeah.
And we were the only ones on the red carpet.
Right.
Literally, we were the only ones on the red carpet, and it was like three photographers are like, we posed and like we had the picture, but people don't know that we were the only ones there. But this time around, we got there late, and all of us like traveled that morning. And by the time we got there, like E Live was there, Ryan Seacrest was doing his thing.
Yeah.
They didn't know who we were. They're like, oh yeah, nominees. So it was actually a little more hurrah.
Oh, good.
This time around on the...
Well, you know what? It was amazing this year. They actually had a feature of Cardi B with Chloe, the concert pianist that played with Cardi B. And did you notice that there's a cross-pollination of different genres at the Grammys?
Well, it's funny,
I mean, there was
that,
one
funny
in that,
that
example,
you mention it. You know, the album that won over ours, the Kronos Quartet actually produced an album this year with Laurie Anderson. So that was kind of a crossover.
You know, if some of you may not know in the audience, I think we have some great fans here of the Criers, and I'm just learning a little bit more this year about them. It's been around since 2007, right? So this is the 19th year.
No.
Right?
12th
year, speaking of math.
It's a math problem.
I was 2019. Told there would be no math.
It's a math problem.
3 Grammys in 12 years.
Ron's a doctor.
That's one per... Okay, anyway, we won't do that. But you notice that there's no conductor. But what's really interesting is the concept of the democratic criers. I'm curious how that works in practice. How does that work on a daily basis? Do you guys bring ideas together? Do you bring, I have this new piece I want to talk about? Give me some examples of that democracy that is so wonderful about A Far Cry.
Yeah, well, I mean, it starts with co-artistic ownership. We don't have a single leader, so we all fill that role at a given time. One of the things that makes us very unique is that we don't have a set group of principal players, so not the first chairs of each section are not set, but instead we all rotate in and out of those positions for a given piece that we're working on. So all of us lead at a given point, and also all of us get to really fill that supporting role a lot too. And there's something very meaningful in both of those roles, and to be able to get to see each and every individual in the group in that capacity.
This week you're actually seeing sort of a crystallization of what the whole band is. There's 18 of us usually that go on stage, and so this is...
What was the analogy used?
It's like if Brookline High usually brings their football team, they brought their basketball team tonight.
For a pickup game.
Right. For a pickup game. So there's 6 of us here, and that's the concert that we're playing this weekend. So it's kind of a new thing that we're implementing, trying to do more chamber music throughout the year. But, you know, we have our full group concerts all throughout the year in Boston at the Gardner Museum and in Jordan Hall at New England Conservatory.
You mentioned team, and we've talked on the podcast about that sports analogy. And it's really interesting to see together the trio, or we're gonna have the pleasure to see the quintet soon, some of the body language, even the breathing, some of the eye contact. Can you describe some of that communication that happens between musician, and how does that feel?
Oh, everyone's looking at me. Okay. Well, I think when you make music together, you get to know one another in a completely different unspoken way, in addition to the normal friendships that we create. And like you said, we learn how the other one breathes. We learn what that glint in their eye means right before they do something really special. You learn to communicate without words. And one of the really fun things about A Far Cry, and I think one of the things that makes it really unique, is that rotating cast of leadership means that we all have an opportunity to have our voice heard in terms of the rehearsal process and contributing ideas to the process, but also feeling like when we're in those leadership roles that it does feel like you have a whole team behind you supporting you, and that they know almost what you're going to do before you even do it, because you get to know each other in a deeper, deeper way. You can almost read each other's minds. That's the goal, at least.
And that there's a lot of listening, too, in addition to all the other cues. There's the way that someone is preparing their sound tells you a lot about what their next sound is going to be and when.
And even in that, people's personalities come out. Like, I was really enjoying actually listening to the Dvorak, because there were certain themes that appeared in each voice, and while it was super cohesive, you could also you could hear these guys' personalities and the way that they approached the same material.
Yeah, I was looking for that like kind of guitar face that you see on lead guitarists. You don't get that as much, but it is subtle. You know, I don't get to see a lot of classical music, and that's my burden to bear, because I love classical music. But I'm wondering, as you go out and you play, and I'm sure you're playing in front of a lot of kids and stuff, the one thing I always forget when I go to a performance, especially when I'm sitting right in front of you, how amazingly beautiful it sounds. The 3 violins, you hear it on the radio, you hear it in your car, you hear it maybe in a CD or something, and it sounds great, but when it's live in front of you, it's astounding, really, how it sounds. And I wonder if, do you see that kind of, awe in the kids' faces when you're playing in front of kids or in front of an audience? Do you see that kind of recognition as what have I been missing? Because I feel it every time I do something like this.
Yeah, it's one of the joys of live performance, I think, is that you actually get to see the interaction of the people on stage. You're not only hearing the beauty of the music, but you're seeing the actual musical conversation take place. Mm-hmm. And that's a whole different thing that you can't always capture so easily in a recording. But yeah, you mentioned playing for kids, and it's funny because so many of our stories, I love actually doing these outreaches because a lot of times you learn so much about your colleagues actually while you're doing it. And I find that so often people's stories start with, and this group came and played for my school, or I saw this violinist come and demonstrate something for our school. And so much can be transferred through those kinds of trips.
I think just generally how recorded music is being decimated as we know it. I mean, at least the way things have been. I mean, you know, I used to go out to Tower Records, and buying CDs was an activity. You know, I used to actually like go on dates at Tower Records. But I think the classical music definitely benefits from that, because along with all the other people not really going out to buy actual CDs or records or even download a full album, and nowadays it's all about the singles, you know. But I think what it also benefits us is that people tend to go out and want to see the real performers perform. You want to like have the sweat come on your face. You're like, oh my god, that's real. Wow, that's awesome. You know, I think that's sort of the kinetic energy that you can bring to the audience. More of it, I think, it's for us, it's a good paradigm right now.
I think you have that with any kind of music.
It's true.
People aren't just going to see music as much as they used to. And it's only recently when I started this podcast that I started making a serious effort to go out and see music. And now I've been seeing so much music, I jones for it when I don't see it. And people don't know what they're missing. They forget that I haven't gone to a concert in 20 years. And they forget they haven't gone and seen live music. So it was fantastic. I love it.
I wanted to talk just briefly about the Dvorak Trio, what you played. It struck me that he wrote this in 1889 or whatever it was, late 1800s. What's amazing is that there's been trios that have been playing that and reading each other's body language and sweating and breathing and communicating with each other for 150 years or whatever that is. Math, I forgot. What is that feeling once you've completed and you've mastered something like that and you think about the history of it over the years? Is it too overwhelming? Tell me about that.
Well, I think you channel a lot of that history. When we were rehearsing it the other day, the Dvorak, I think we were talking about the slow movement and said something like, let's just go for that really old school sound in the pianissimos. And we all knew what we were talking about without having to talk, that we wanted to have it sound exactly like, you know, a Milstein recording or something like that. But
more oscillation.
Yeah, faster resolution or something. But you're always leaning on that history anytime you take the instrument out of the case and put it under your neck, really. But I feel like you're never trying to reach your aspiration is not necessarily, I mean, I speak for myself, but I think a lot of us would agree, not necessarily to completely master something, to experience it in that moment, in that time. You're right, it is just a blip on the timeline of performances of that piece. It's crazy.
And I guess not just a performance, but it's like a poem or a book or something that's, you know, people have been reading, you know, Emerson for years. They'll maybe have a different interpretation or a piece of art that you see.
I think it's more, think of it more like King Lear. You know, I mean, people have been playing, you know, Shakespeare for ages, but you have to embody it and digest it in order to make it your own. And I think a lot of times classical music, especially when we perform older pieces from 120 years ago, or have it be Beethoven or Bach, it's about digesting it and putting it out in the moment as part of you. And I think that's why the living,
you
breathing...
personalize it.
Yeah, living, yeah. Breathing of the moment music happens at that point. I mean, like, you know, we play the music that we love because they're tried and true masterpieces.
Why a lot of us feel like it's not about mastering something, because it's going to be different every time you come back to it. The music is a masterwork that you're constantly digging deeper and deeper within and searching for more. It's different when you come back to it at a different time in your life. And I think that's one of the reasons, you mentioned that Dvorak wrote this 150 years ago. Well, you know, it is a masterwork, but the reason people are still coming to hear it live is because each performance is different. And that's true for each different group that performs it is going to bring something different to it, but the same group that plays it twice won't play it exactly the same the second time. And that's one of the extraordinary things about these pieces.
So I love stringed instruments. And when my daughter took violin at school, you can buy for like $30 an old traded in violin at
$30
at the guitar. It was like a school. The schools were done with it, and they sold it back. Luckily, it's buried in my closet, and I haven't used it. But I love the stringed instruments, and the renaissance of stringed instruments, not only with classical music, but also with Americana, with bluegrass. We talked to Mike Block. He was playing, what was that song he was playing with the kids? Happy.
Oh, yeah.
He's playing Happy with the Kids.
Yeah.
These stringed instruments can be used in all types of music nowadays. So my long-winded question is, are you guys doing other things either on the side? Is something that a Far Cry is doing? Are you doing other things other than classical music with your instruments?
We do a lot of collaborations as a Far Cry with artists, all kinds of different artists. I think it comes to the idea the string instrument is very much like, I think it's closest to the sound of a voice, in some sort of scientific way.
The timbre is probably, they say, is the closest to the human voice.
And that I think makes it so universally adaptable to so many different styles. But yeah, we've done everything from tango to jazz to,
You've done Bjork. Who played with Bjork?
We've done all kinds of
stuff. Oh, I played with Bjork.
You played Bjork. Yeah. I love Bjork.
Yeah. We had to sign a waiver that said pyrotechnics on stage while we played were okay.
Oh, really?
I didn't quite understand what that meant until a seriously huge tower of fire shot up from right behind me.
Wow. I wouldn't think Bjork would have a tower of fire. Wow.
You were looking for that $30 violin.
Heard about Bjork?
Yeah.
She's brilliant, but
she's
dangerous. I didn't. Really?
Bjork is. She'd kick your butt.
She's from Iceland, right?
I'm not even kidding. Anyways, I'm sorry.
Fire.
I digress.
We've gone from Dvorak to Bjork, and this has been awesome. So we want to hear from you guys, any questions you have. And so maybe we got 5-10 minutes for questions.
Thank you all so much for a wonderful performance. It was beautiful to listen to. How did you each come about your respective instruments? So I remember going through middle school and high school, and the hardest part was picking which instrument, which path were you going to devote the next 10 years to? What factors sort of changed or altered those decisions for you, especially since there are violists and violinists here? Thank you.
Well, I didn't really have a choice. I was pushed into it by my mom at the tender age of 3. And if I had had a choice, I probably would have said cello, but I didn't. So I just ended up with the hard instrument, having to practice more than anyone else. And
you look so sad.
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, now it's fine, you know. But I mean, well, we still have to practice a lot, so that's my story. Did you guys start with viola?
No, I didn't. Did you?
I did. Yep.
You did?
Yeah, but I want to hear your story first.
I started on violin only because I did eventually see the light. I wanted to be exactly like my older sister, and she started, and so I begged to start, and the violin teacher told me that I couldn't start because I was a voracious thumb sucker, and she said that if I wasn't mature enough to stop sucking my thumb, I wasn't mature enough to play the violin. And I just got better at hiding it, and eventually she let me start. And then I came to my senses in middle school, and I fell in love with the C string. I was asked by a conductor to play viola on a piece that needed, it had 3 different viola parts. It's one of Bach's Brandenburg concertos, and we only had 1 violist in the orchestra, and he was a violist, and he said, "Would you mind playing viola on this piece?" And I was like, "Sure." And then I loved it, and I didn't look back after that.
No. Yeah, I started in 5th grade in the public schools. They had they have an instrument petting zoo, and I told them I wanted to play clarinet or violin, and the string orchestra teacher said, "That's nice. Could you play viola? Because we don't have anybody playing viola." And so for 2 years, I was the only violist in the orchestra, and that's where I learned most of my bad habits early on.
I find that fascinating, Jason, that you actually started on the alto clef.
The alto clef is my home clef. When I watch violinists look at the part and go, or they're going to the score and saying, let's see now, the cello has a C sharp and the viola has a... this is fascinating.
I'm one of those people, yes.
Actually, when I played that Brandenburg 3, yeah. I said, well, I don't know. I don't read alto clef. I don't read the viola clef. And the conductor said, don't worry. The violist will help you. It's like a bad viola joke because I sat down and I was like, okay, that... and I was like trying to figure it out, and he leaned over and he was like, hey, what's that note? Like, this doesn't bode well for our section.
Sounds like a viola section to me.
3, 2, 1, right there.
Just write in all the fingerings.
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking a little bit about what you said earlier about taking your music from 140 years ago that was created on the spot but has made it your own 140 years later or whatever. And people say it's not the same about pop music, but I was kind of wondering. I went to a Beatles tribute band concert, and they all played the Beatles songs very much as they're written, and of course they were injected themselves in their own interpretation of what they're doing. And I'm just wondering, is this just looking at the same thing maybe 70 years apart, or you know, what it's going to be like 100 years from now when people listen to stuff like that, and are they going to have the same sort of feel about this kind of thing?
I think the Beatles already is kind of the classics. I'm always looking out for remixes of everything, finding different quartets playing Beethoven or Smetana or something, but I'm always more interested if Beck's doing a Beatles cover or Bjork is doing a George Harrison cover. I always find those to be really more interesting in how they digest it and make it into their own fabric. I find that to be really sort of the essence of what an artist can do.
But I think there's also something unique about our tradition, at least if you follow it back before there were recordings, and when you're performing works that were composed before they started to make any recordings or any that still exist, then you have to rely on more of a, you know, storytelling kind of oral tradition, basically, combined with a pedagogical tradition to know what the tools are in your tool chest for interpreting and putting together a piece. So I think it is unique, our field, in that sense. We don't have necessarily something already down on a record to reference when we interpret.
One more question. Dr. Wong.
Hi, guys. You're great. I'm curious to hear a little bit about what your process is in choosing composers to commission, and what was one of your favorite creations, an arrangement or a commission?
We have a unique programming process where we have anybody and everybody in the group, all the members of the group, come together and bring their ideas to the table for programming. And so oftentimes, if we're coming to the table with an idea for programming, it might include a program built around a particular composer that we wanted to commission from, or some conversation we'd had with a composer. We also, of course, have wonderful composers in our circle who come to us with their own ideas. We've also gone out and recently commissioned a piano concerto by Philip Glass and people sort of who are very famous and established, long established in their career. So there's all kinds of different composers we've worked with. It's hard for me to pick a favorite necessarily. That's a tough question. Recently we worked with Lemby Beecher, who's fantastic, and wrote a piece called The Conference of the Birds for us, which was such a thoughtfully put together piece that really utilized every single member in the group and kind of tapped into their individual personalities in a way. That piece really resonated with me.
Yeah, that piece is awesome. I have to say, for me, we did a project called Blue Hour last year. It was a sort of a quilt of five different female composers that we put together and put a concert-length song cycle. And we got to work with a Brazilian jazz singer, Luciana Souza, and she came out of her usual element to really embody this piece. And I thought it was, I don't know, there are moments of that piece still. I listen to it and like it just makes me shudder, and like, you know, there's like crying like a little baby. But it's just
He's
so
a
good. It's so good.
Thank you guys very much. Thank you.
We'd like to thank Megumi, Oscar, Caitlin, Jay, and Jason for joining us. A Far Cry is the orchestra in residence of the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum in Boston, and you can find out their schedule there and around the world at afarcry.org. A special thank you as well to Grace Kennerly for helping us organize this ConcertCast event, to our associate Caitlin Holly, sound engineer Ryan Ainsworth, and all the fine people at City Winery Boston. For more information about events at City Winery, go to citywinery.com/Boston. Please go to abovethebasement.com where you can join us on Patreon, sign up for our newsletter, listen and subscribe to our podcast, like our Facebook page, follow us on Twitter, and look at all the nice pictures we post on Instagram. We are everywhere. On behalf of Ronnie and myself, thanks for listening. Tell your friends, and remember, Boston music, like its history, is unique. Hey, it's Chuck again. We would like to take a quick second to appeal to you to subscribe to this podcast, Above the Basement. There are many really good reasons to subscribe, but I'll tell you just two of them. You never have to check to see if we have new episodes, as they are automatically listed on your podcast app, and it doesn't cost you anything. Just go to abovethebasement.com/subscribe, where we have links to all the major podcast apps, including iTunes, Stitcher, Radio Public, and more. There are instructions there on how to subscribe, or you can just click on one of the subscribe buttons. If you're already have a podcast app on your phone, for the most part, you can just open the app and you will see a magnifying glass on the interface. Just tap on that and type Above the Basement. You should see us right at the top. Tap on the subscribe button and you are done. And while you are there, please write us a nice review. Subscribes and reviews in the podcast universe are an important piece to reaching more listeners, so please take 15 or 20 seconds and help spread the word about ATB. Thank you for your support.